This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Hey, everyone. It's Estelle Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century. And that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your Addicted to Beef Stallion of the Year of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Killer, let's go. I get the boosters boosting, I get computers puting. Y'all get shot at, call me, I do the recruiting. I tutor the students, I nurture their brain. I'm moving the movement, whether Buddhist or Buddha. That's Judas or Judah, I got Luga the Root. Hit from Ruda to Tuda, chick from Huda to Huda. I put two on producers.
We're back. Had to take a little vacation. Thank you to everyone in Santa Fe and New Mexico. Had a tremendous time down there last week. Shouts out to BMI and to Ileana, who had a beautiful wedding. And you know we stay up in the Santa Fe Vintage Warehouse, obviously. Salute to Scott. We see you. While I was on vacation, I learned that the Village Voice was shutting down for good, not just online. It already shut down the print edition, but was shutting down for good. Quick sidebar, if anybody has a plug on a red Village Voice box, please hit me with an email at podcast.nytimes.com. The Voice was incredibly formative for me, both as a reader and a writer. I used to read The Voice when I would come back and forth from Brooklyn to high school in Manhattan. It was stunning to see criticism about the music I cared about and also a bunch of music I didn't care about, but still criticism being done at that high a level. It was the first time it ever occurred to me that people took music as seriously as I took music. It was also the place where I did a lot of my earliest important criticism, or at least important to me. I don't know if anybody else. We opened with Cam's Get 'Em Girls, which is off Purple Haze. Purple Haze is a record I reviewed for The Voice. Famously or infamously, depending who you ask in the rap internet. I'm just scrolling through my author page on the Voice website, and there are a lot of quiet gems on here. There is a very early kind of like reggaeton crossover 1.0 roundup that I remember spending a tremendous amount of time on. I reviewed the Julie Roberts first album, which remains one of my favorite albums really of all time. I see a fanny pack review here. Salute to Matt and Fancy and that whole crew. We've got MC Paul Barman. I've got a Master P Goody Mob joint review, an early art review. There was a hip-hop themed or hip-hop inspired art show at the Bronx Museum of the Arts. That was the first time I ever wrote about art. I'm out here trying to coin the phrase post-rap in a piece about NERD and a bunch of other people. And also my first cover story. This is back in 99. It's loosely pegged to Black Star, and it's about the sort of rise of political hip hop or the new wave of political hip hop. Definitely have 200 copies of that at my mother's house right now. So if anybody needs one, I guess drop me an email and I'll probably send you one because I have a lot of them. So anyway, The Voice is incredibly important to me, and I want to use this episode of Popcast, and actually two episodes of Popcast, special two-parter, to celebrate the music criticism legacy of The Village Voice. So we're going to be talking to a bunch of different people over the next couple of episodes from various eras in The Voice, and remember what it was like to kind of create the sound of music criticism, or at least be very heavily responsible for creating the sound of music criticism as we have come to understand it today.
We're going to talk to a lot of voice folks over this episode and the next episode. On this episode, we're going to talk to our own John Pareles, Nelson George, Kyle Gann, Joe Levy, and you know, if we're talking about the Village Voice music criticism, you know we got to start with the dean. Bob Christgau's here. Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Okay, John.
So grateful to have some of your time today. As I was telling you earlier, it's your house. We're just living in it. So just for the edification of our listeners who may not be totally familiar with Bob's oeuvre, if you have ever been moved by a record review and felt something strongly about it, if you ever thought that a review written in 20 words was more effective than a written review written in 2,000 words, you probably have Bob to thank. Bob was for many years the main critical voice as regards to music at the Village Voice and pioneered the consumer guide format. He is currently a weekly columnist at Noisy under the name Expert Witness. There's a book coming out, Is It Still Good to You? 50 Years of Rock Criticism, 1967 to 2017. That's coming out in October on Duke. And if you go to robertchriscow.com, as I encourage you to do, pretty much all the consumer guide columns from back in the day are archived and searchable, and there is a font of fun stuff there. Hey, Bob, again, thank you for being here. When did you first arrive at The Voice, and what was The Voice like when you arrived there in terms of music critical sensibilities?
Well, there's three different kinds of arriving. When did I start to read it? When did I start to write there? Or when did I actually become the editor?
Let's start with the reading, and then
I started reading it
in
1956 when I was a sophomore or junior in high school in Flushing, and I had never been to Greenwich Village. I was immediately taken with it. It created a vision of the village, augmented by the guy who sent me there, a radio personality, not a music person, named Gene Shepherd. And then when I was at Dartmouth, I read it. You know, that's a long way from New York. New York was my mecca, and The Voice was my guide to that mecca. By then, I was a jazz fan, and I read about jazz in The Voice, although for The Voice's 50th anniversary, I was asked to do a retrospective of The Voice's music coverage. And going back and checking carefully, I found that I didn't think that the music writing was terribly good the first 10 years. Both Nat Hentoff and Martin Williams, probably the two most important jazz critics in America in the 50s, wrote there, but neither of them wrote about jazz. Hentoff did sometime because he had a lot of freedom.
What were they writing about?
Williams was writing about comics, which he also really cared about, and TV as well. Really, the first, I would say, truly distinguished music critic to be at The Voice was Richard Goldstein, who I always call the inventor of rock criticism, although Jan Wenner was, as a writer, was added at around the same time he began in San Francisco. And there were fanzines and so forth before that. But Richard made rock criticism seem like a possibility, and it was something I had on my own mind because I was very interested in what I like to call pop, but it was Goldstein who made it seem like a real career option. I saw it at the time as a fallback, and I was going to do more reportage. I didn't want to be a critic. Quickly, I became the pop music critic at Esquire, which lasted 8 columns over 2 years because I didn't write enough about jazz, and they thought rock and roll was baloney. And when that ended, Goldstein had gotten tired of his gig, and we were friends, and I walked over to the Voice's offices, which were then in this tiny building on Sheridan Square. Tiny. Talked to Dan Wolf. He recognized my name from the letters column, gave me the job. That's all he knew about me. I'd written for Esquire, and he read some letters by me.
Did you feel that there was, in the Goldstein era, at minimum, a sort of honed, whether it was a critical idea about how pop music should be written about, either in a broad aesthetic sense or at least on the writer-by-writer level?
Well, at that time, it was Goldstein himself. And when I got there, Goldstein was a flashy, funny, personal, eccentric, emotional writer. And like many people who wrote for The Voice, he really had his own voice. That was what was always so distinctive about The Voice, was that there were recognizable literary journalistic, let's hyphenated, voices there.
Did you feel by the time you arrived that you had already honed your own voice, or was that still a work in progress?
Well, I felt I'd honed my own voice, but I hadn't. I look back at that early. Well, for one thing, they were paying so little. I mean, they were paying $40 for a column of between 1,500 and 2,500 words. And I decided I was going to go back to my college days and do all-nighters, that it was just wrong to be spending more of my time. So a lot of my earlier pieces there, they begin well and end kind of sloppy. and then I conceived the consumer guide like 4 months into that gig. And my early consumer guides are terrible.
Tell me about the consumer guide as a concept, because I assume partially it was a response to the amount, just the sheer volume.
That's correct. I was listening to everything. I thought it was my job to listen to everything.
Still is.
I don't think any. Well, no. I know, no. It's not physically possible.
Well, you know, but it's still the right way to do the work in my mind, and I know in yours is to listen to as much as
you can,
as much as you can cram in.
Right. I mean, this was the hippie era.
Yep. So, what year is Consumer Guide? What's the first Consumer Guide year?
It's 1969. I'm trying to remember the month. June or July.
Right. So you're in it. Everything is happening.
I can't write about everything I'm listening to. So I thought it would be a good idea to start writing capsule reviews and using grades, which this was the high hippie era. Grading was considered a sin.
Yeah.
I knew that I was being provocative by doing this because I didn't think it was sinful at all. I've always believed that quantification was an important part of analytic thinking, and I still do.
And can you talk about the broader climate of music criticism at that time? Who were you competing with? How did you try to
Rolling
differentiate?
Rolling Stone and Cream. Rolling Stone and Cream, and to a lesser extent, a magazine called Circus, and what remained of Paul Williams' Crawdaddy. They were both still around.
How did you try to make the Voices criticism stand apart?
By finding the best writers and saying that Janet Maslin could coexist with Lester Banks.
Right.
That they belonged in the same format, that these were both good ways to write about music. Stephen Holden was there as well, another Times person. He was from Rolling Stone. Both Maslin and Holden were Rolling Stone people. And then I kept finding people.
Bob, I've been to your apartment once, and I found it very relatable. I don't know if it's exactly as it was when I was there many years ago.
No, it's more crowded. It's more crammed now.
Okay, so you live in the recorded history of popular music, best I can tell. I remember you telling me that you had been culling by grade, by, you know, getting rid of honorable mentions or getting rid of B minuses. I don't know if that's still an ongoing process, but it's a really admirable commitment to the form. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about your personal relationship with music as expressed through the writing over the years. Has it ever waned? Has it ever faded?
I would say about every year or two, I wake up one day and don't feel like hearing any electric guitars.
Well,
but I always get over it.
Okay, well, I woke up one day like that and I never got over it. So so I do find that relatable. Another thing I know is that you, at least up until a certain point, saved all the correspondence. And I know there's some famous correspondence you've received over the years, and I wonder if you wouldn't mind sharing a couple of the more...
John, I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, come on.
I honestly don't.
Didn't someone send you a condom?
That was Michael Gira.
Okay. What was that in response to?
His general bloody-mindedness.
Okay.
Sexist, ugly, nihilist, stupid. No, he's not actually stupid. He's just a jerk.
Okay. Well, and this is a safe space to express that opinion. Anything else pop into mind? A particularly ungenerous or perhaps generous replies to your work?
Yeah, some associate of the Stranglers threatened to slip my wife a bit of British beef.
Wow.
And if I ever wrote anything bad about the Stranglers again, and I solved that by writing him back and said, oh, that's simple. I'll never, ever mention the Stranglers again for as long as I live.
I thought you would tell him that British beef is generally subpar. So
I have had a few death threats over the years.
Sure.
Not too many, but a few.
Yeah. And I think any good critic probably has one or two.
But threatening my wife?
Yeah, that's beyond the pale.
Absolutely.
Okay, before we close up, I'd be remiss if I didn't tell you that the one time that you edited me at The Voice remains among the most terrifying days of my professional career. So thank you for that. That's I will never forget exactly that conversation. And it was great.
Well, I edited people really hard.
Yeah.
And but I always, always tried to respect their voice. I did not try to impose my voice on theirs, which is what I think some editors, some of them good ones even, do. I always tried to find their voice. That was, but to make it as effective as it could be. That was crucial for me.
It was a really eye-opening process, so thank you for that. Bob, thank you again for calling in. So grateful to talk to you today.
All right. Thanks a lot, John.
So in the 70s, Chris Gow is helping to sort of define the sound of Village Voice music criticism. And then in the late 70s, someone comes along who I know is very familiar to podcast listeners and friends of the New York Times. And that is John Pareles, our chief pop music critic. What up, JP?
What up?
So, JP, people who read you in the Times may not know that before you were here, starting in 82, you were at The Voice. You started writing at The Voice in the late 70s, and you were the music editor for a minute in the early 80s. Tell me about The Voice as a reader before you even show up. When did you first encounter it, and what's your take on it? What does it make you think?
Well, I got to New York in 77. I was aware of The Voice before that as a music fan, but I got there in 77, and it was it and the Soho Weekly News, RIP, were the only thing in town. And The Voice was, it was like, pardon the expression, the pitchfork of its era. It was the beacon of integrity. It was the, we get the cool stuff first. It was really smart writing. Chris Gow was a taskmaster. Mm-hmm. Chris Gow did not publish anything that was not really well thought out and well written and had excellent prose, but also had a real argument to make. He really set the standard high, and he would work really hard with anybody he edited to make sure it met that standard. If that meant like five rewrites, if that meant a 3-hour comma by comma editing session, he would do that. Of course, he didn't have to do that with me because my copy just like zooms into print.
Obviously. To this day, never nary a red mark on your proofs.
Yeah, no blue pencils for me, baby. But you learned from an edit with Chris Gow about how to construct an argument, how to write a piece, where you needed an example, where you needed to, you know, make a bold statement. It was always an education. So I give it up to Bob. And people weren't doing that. I mean, rock criticism was still in its infancy, pretty much. You know, I guess it kind of had started a decade earlier. But still, it was people figuring out as they went along. But the other thing about rock criticism at the time was it was so different in the era before total access to music. It wasn't like, oh, you know, what does Captain Beefheart sound like? I'll go to Spotify. There was no Spotify. You probably couldn't find a Captain Beefheart record in your record store unless you were in a big city. There was this an entirely different relationship with music, and people looked to the press, I certainly did, to find out what I should listen to. You know, the top 40 was one thing. MTV came along in 80, 81. But, you know, when I started being a rock critic, it was the records you could get and the records you heard and the records, you know, somebody told you about and you went out and bought.
I also just, in what you're saying reminds me of something I actually heard Bob say once in a talk or a moderated conversation or something. He made the case that I thought was pretty convincing that certainly in that era, maybe slightly less so now, but in that era, that criticism, especially as practiced in the New York culture scene, was news, because criticism, it sort of separates the wheat from the chaff. It kind of tells you what's worth paying attention to, what's not worth paying attention to. Obviously, a lot of these young artists aren't necessarily going to be profiled, certainly not in that era, but that critics were sort of doing this kind of functional sorting of what you should pay attention to and what you should be aware of. That resonated for me.
Well, absolutely. And you know, there was top 40 radio in New York. You were lucky enough to have some good college radio stations, But that was the outlet. And you would have club bookers of the era that would bring the bands to you. There was this little place called CBGB you may have heard of.
I think you're referring to the John Varvatos store, but I don't know.
It was a really different era for access to music. And critics were kind of essential. And I mean, Bob brought a real sense of mission to the gig. You know, it wasn't just consumer advice filtering. It was, how do we listen to this? How do we approach this? What does this mean to the wider culture? I mean, all of the things that that separate criticism from reviewing. And The Voice really set that standard. I mean, I couldn't believe that I could get in to The Voice when I finally got my first assignment.
So it was a big deal. It was a big deal.
Such a big deal. Yeah. It was the cool kid gold standard, and I was still just a nerd. So it was a really great thing.
You told me on email or on text, I can't remember, the circumstances of your first assignment. Do you want to tell the people?
Not really.
You're not going to mention your man's name?
Nope.
Okay.
Nope, I'm not. Okay. But suffice it to say that somebody had not come through with an assignment, and Bob knew that I knew about the band, and he called me and had me do the story. I mean, I'd been in New York for a couple of years. I was actually working as an editor at Crawdaddy. So I wasn't an over the transom manuscript. People knew who I was, but it was still such an honor to be in The Voice. The Voice, you know, you go back to Norman Mailer, you go back to all of the great critics that were in there, you know, Jay Hoberman, all these incredible minds were working for The Voice, and to be a byline in that nice fat type was really a good feeling.
Good fonts.
Yeah, excellent fonts. So what happened was that Bob took a year off to write his first consumer guide book and brought me in as a limited time pinch hitter because he knew I was very self-editing and would edit other people. So I had the gig for the year of being the Village Voice music editor. And, you know, I thought it was heaven. It was really the best gig in the world. Until I got this one.
That's right. Can you talk about what role The Voice played in sort of the broader music writing, music criticism space? Because to me, even though I may have read great music writing, and then I'm talking in a later era, but I might have read great writing in a Rolling Stone or a Spin or a Vibe or The Source, The Voice was very much its own thing. It was like in conversation. I often felt only with itself.
First of all, Spin, Vibe, The Source, they didn't exist.
Right. That's what I'm saying. A later era.
they were completely non-existent. Bob always did like density in his prose, and he didn't mind if you were speaking from fan to fan. There wasn't that obligation that we have now at the Times to write for a general interest reader. It was like you're writing for the people who will understand your arcane references. That was very different at The Voice. That was one transition I had to make when I came to the Times.
I miss dropping those gems in. I miss that. I'm going to start doing that again.
I have to say I don't. I think it's a wall between you and the reader, but that's the philosophy I've come around to. It was very cool at the time. Yeah. But, you know, editing it, there was this stable of really smart people. I mean, I was editing Gary Giddens, the great jazz critic, every week. I was editing Leighton Koerner and Greg Sandow, the classical critics, every week. I was learning from these people. And of course, you know, they knew which loft to go to on a Thursday night to sit on a cushion on the floor and hear some minimalistic ritual go on for 6 hours. So, I mean, it was also a great time to be in New York. I mean, before the rents got crazy, you know, when artists could actually make a living in New York by driving a cab like Philip Glass, it was a good time to be here.
Do you feel like your critical voice was kind of already fixed by the time you got to the paper, or were you still just kind of like a work in progress?
I'm still a work in progress.
That's right.
Also, it was already broken, maybe.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I learned every day. I also learned a lot from editing people. It broadens your sense of writing strategy. It broadens your taste. It's a really good thing for the mind.
Can you talk a little bit about what it was like being at The Voice, like actually being there in that late 70s into early 80s moment?
Okay, typewriters.
Yeah. What are those?
Little offices, some of which had been occupied by the same people for 20 years, who had never thrown away a file. Well, like
that's
Matt
just
Hentoff.
Like my apartment. That's not that big a deal.
Yeah, true. but also just there was a sense of you were at the intellectual center of the city. You were with the smart kids.
Yeah.
And the smart adults. I mean, you know, people who were a decade older than me or 2 decades older than me who had been covering their field for all that time. There were a lot of really clever, intelligent, committed people. But, you know, there was also that sense in the rock press at the time that we were really doing the work of being the countervailing force against mediocrity. When you called me about doing this, I looked up some of Bob's Paz and Jop poll essays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And okay, into like the 15th paragraph of his 1983 Paz and Jop essay about how relieved he was that the Paz and Jop people had chosen Thriller mm-hmm. over REM's Murmur, a critics band. He just tossed, this is in the middle of a paragraph. And he wrote, "I believe that people who convert their musical perceptions into written discourse have a special role in keeping the music honest." You know, this was just the tone of the time in the rock press. This was like people were really committed. You had to be nuts to do this. You know, it wasn't a career. It wasn't a gig. It was something you did because what you wanted to do was listen to music and think about it all the time. And, you know, across the Voice in all the critical fields, movies, books, everything in the art section of the Voice, were just like very committed, passionate people. So it was a great place to be.
Do you feel that part of that was because of how small music criticism was just as an enterprise at that time? Like, obviously now everybody's a music critic. Do you think part of it was about this broader sense of, you know, we're all engaged in this special, small, niche pursuit that's so meaningful?
Yeah, I think part of it was that. I mean, the rock press was a really small thing and you really had to be, and it was self-selected. It was a self-selected bunch of music nerds. But the Voice itself, though, was also very conscious of itself as a literary enterprise and as an intellectual enterprise. And so you weren't just the music press, you were also the Village Voice. And there was always a really special aura about the Voice.
And do you have any particular, whether it's a memorable piece that you wrote or piece that you edited, like anything that kind of like sticks in your mind from that era?
I wrote about the first U2 album, and I was using my music school stuff, which I know you hate.
I'm just not learned. That's all it is.
But the headline, which I think Bob was editing this. I don't think I assigned this to myself. I have to check the dates on U2's first album. But the review is called U2 Takes the Fifth. The reason it was called that was because U2's chords are, they're not chords really at the time. They're the tonic and the fifth. So, I mean, that's why it rings like that. So I was writing about that, and I suggested that they, having made this magnificent album, they break up because they could never be that innocent again. So that worked.
Well, that's advice I wish they would have taken. But but yes, that album came out in October of 1980. So just for context.
So maybe I did assign it to myself.
Damn. And then, JP, you got plucked from The Voice and brought up to the show. Not that The Voice wasn't the show, but and now you've been at The Times since I can read newspapers, basically. And I remain grateful to you, and I appreciate you sharing some of the back in the day gems with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
One of the things that was quite unusual and exceptional about The Voice, especially in the late 70s going into the early 80s, is how seriously it took hip hop, how important it realized it was, and how much serious critical attention it gave it. Someone who started writing about hip hop very early in the Village Voice in the early 80s is Nelson George. And if you know anything about hip hop journalism, you know Nelson was there at day one. Nelson lives in LA now. He is a producer on an upcoming Cinemax show, which is called Tales from the Tour Bus. I last spoke to Nelson because he worked on The Get Down, the Netflix Baz Luhrmann show. And Nelson's on the phone now. Hey, man, what's up?
I'm good.
In 2018, there are so few things that are uncharted territory or unassessed or uncritiqued territory. But in that moment, that was not the case. So I wonder if you can talk about hip hop in the late 70s into the early 80s as a physical lived experience, and then what it was like to try to bring that into the pages of an institution like The Voice.
Hip hop was very much a outer borough or uptown thing. You did see kids maybe doing spinning on their head on cardboard boxes in Times Square for money in that period, but there was very little contact, or zero really contact, between the institutions of music and media and the record companies and this thing going on in, you know, uptown and in the Bronx,
which had been going on since the early to mid 70s.
Yeah. I think Herc says his first party was 73 or 74.
Yep. I think 73. Yeah.
I was interning at the Amsterdam News in Harlem, and I was an intern at Billboard magazine. So I was kind of running all over town. And there I had a mentor, a guy named Robert Ford. We called him Rocky. And he had heard from people at Downstairs Records, which is this legendary record store that was in the Sixth Avenue train station, about these kids from uptown buying what they called cutout records, which were the records that hadn't sold that were then discounted to, you know, $2.99, $1.99, even 99 cents. They were buying these records in bulk. I went up one Saturday afternoon with Rocky to the South Bronx. We went to a high school that's off the concourse, and there was a bunch of kids waiting. A van pulls up, a bunch of people get out, guys with crates of records, card tables, electric wiring. They unscrew the base of a light pole, and they pull a wire through the fence, and lo and behold, this is guy's name. His name is Kool Herc. So I've seen rapping, but I hadn't really seen the DJing in the park that way. It blew me away because he was playing nothing, pretty much nothing that was on the radio. Or if he's playing stuff on the radio, he's playing it very differently than what I'd heard. But it wasn't hip hop. It was kind of like this culture without a name that was just happening around the city. And I remember I wrote an article initially for the Amsterdam News in July 1978 about Kool Herc, which is the first time. It may be, I don't know if it's the first hip hop article, but it's either one or two. There can't have been more before this.
Look, at that point, you are seeing how this stuff is either being received or not received in the press. Did you feel kind of almost like a moral responsibility to get it coverage? Did it feel urgent to you? Did you feel like you had a purview on this thing that nobody else had, and therefore like you could be the one to carry it out into the world through the press?
I grew up in New York. I grew up reading the Village Voice, and I loved Andrew Sarah's film reviews, and I loved all the record reviews. And I would see that they were actually, unlike Rolling Stone and unlike a lot of the other rock press that I read, because I was reading everything, as you're a kid, Cream and all that, it really covered black music a lot. They covered R&B, they covered funk, they covered jazz. And so I was determined to, okay, that seemed like the place to go. And I heard about this guy, Robert Christgau. Now, I actually have somewhere in my possession three rejections. I have two typed letters of rejection and another like form letter that I got from Christgau when I was in college. I was sending him stuff when I was in college. And I got a nice, he sent me one that said basically the writing was good, but not vivid. You know, he kind of let me down easy. Mm-hmm. And then another one I sent, Joe McEwen had already written about the record. So that was done. And the third one, I didn't even get a letter. He just sent me a form letter. So I had like three rejection letters from The Voice from like, I would say 79 to 80 through there. So in 81, now I have my own job. I have a job, and I actually have access to concerts and getting free tickets and stuff. So I see Christgau at The Bottom Line, which was the number one showcase spot in New York at that time.
The jumping spot.
Yeah, it was an amazing spot. You see, basically back then, you as a music writer, you would have been there. You could have been there five nights a week. There was so much going on there.
Right.
So I see Christgau, and the place was had very narrow aisles. And so I have him cornered. And basically, he said he was aware of my work. I wasn't ready for The Voice yet, but, keep trying. And so finally, okay, I said my way into The Voice had to be something no one else would write about. And so I found a 12-inch record by Lovebug Starsky. And Lovebug, it was on Harlem World Records, but Harlem World was a club on 116th Street and Lenox. That was one of the early hip-hop clubs. So Lovebug has a record that's called You Gotta Believe. So that's the hook. And so I got a chance. I pitched it to Chris Gow as what they called. So Riff was a big article,
right?
And he started something called Licks, which was
right
shorter
with the short
one.
Ones, yeah.
So he gave me a shot with a short one, and that's the first piece I had in The Voice. That was sometime in '81, and then I came back with another piece, which actually was probably a better written piece, which was about Grandmaster Flash and the Great Adventures in the Wheel of Steel, which was the first record to really have the idea of DJ mixing on vinyl. And it was hip hop that got me in the building.
Even though you'd been writing for other places, obviously the nature of criticism in The Voice was different than it was in some of these other outlets. Was it important to you as a writer to have hip hop treated that same way as rock, jazz, classical, et cetera, in the pages of The Voice?
I felt like it was important to get any black music in there. There was a guy named Pablo Guzman who was writing about Latin as well as R&B. And it was Vernon Gibbs, who also was writing a lot about funk and R&B. But basically, there weren't very many black writers writing there. And there weren't certainly people writing about stuff that I cared about.
Yeah.
You know, hip-hop was an uncharted territory. There was an opportunity for someone like me to get my foot in the door there. For me, it was like, this is a world that no adults seem to care about. No black adults cared about, I can tell you that. Trying to pitch hip-hop articles to black adults in the early 80s was like, come on. And they didn't care. They didn't want to care. They were very, very dismissive of it. And that Chris Gow and The Voice, which was more of an alternative place, you know, gave you a shot. I mean, Sally Baines had already, I think, done her big article on breakdancing.
Yes.
There. So there's already a space where they were interested. So, yeah, The Voice seemed like a perfect place to be. Also, there was the Soho Weekly News that was, you know,
sure,
around.
Sure.
So it seemed like the alternative downtown press was going to be the spots where you got in. I mean, Barry Michael Cooper, who wrote The Voice before I did, wrote both for The Voice and for Soho Weekly News. So that was a place you could really write about this stuff and not have to hold back. When I was also writing for Black fanzines to make a living, and you know, you can only write, but so you know, you can only get so sophisticated in the writing. So The Voice was the only place that you could write about this hip hop culture and not hold back on what you thought about, or not hold back on the language.
Did the artists that you were writing about, did they read you? Was it that intimate where they knew that you were a person that was writing about them, and they would, and because The Voice is a local paper, they would pick up The Voice and there was a dialogue?
Well, yeah. I mean, again, The Voice was a downtown paper. So a lot of the uptown people didn't know about it or didn't read it regularly until their world started getting covered in it. But the amazing thing about being a music writer at The Voice, especially I would say in that 80s period, was it, you know, I think The Voice came out on Wednesday, maybe. And then Friday, everyone picked it up to figure out what to do for the weekend or what happened. And you'd get this real buzz Friday night if you went out to a concert or to a club, or Saturday, or, you know, if you were around some spot where a lot of music people would be, you get all this feedback. It was very like, I guess it was, you know, it's like going out, if I had written a piece on Flash, or I'd written a piece on, you know, any Eric B and Rakim, I made a big piece on, I remember. When you went out that weekend, you people, you know, knew who you were and knew what the writing was and knew what it was about, and you get into dialogues about it. And that was a beautiful thing about The Voice. And your audience was very, very music savvy. The other thing about The Voice is that as the 80s went on, Chris Gow, who I think was probably the major recruiter of black talent at The Voice, in my opinion, you know, you see Greg Tate and Lisa Jones and Harry Allen and Carol Cooper and Barry Michael Cooper. And there was a room when they were on Broadway, when they were on Broadway, the movie theater is now on 13th. There was a room near the front of the building that was kind of a writer, freelance writer's hangout room. Mm-hmm. And you go in there and you know, you could spend an afternoon talking about Sun Ra was Tate, or Miles was Tate, or, you know, Wynton was Tate, or talk to Barry about, you know, Bootsy or George Clinton, or talk to Cal Cooper about salsa. I mean, like, the amount of talent that was just hanging out there was so stimulating. And also was a place in which then your writing had to step up, because you were writing for you're not writing for the audience, you're writing for your peers who are right there in the room with you, you know? I mean, it was such a big deal. When you got, if you got the lead riff, that was huge.
Right.
You got the lead riff and got on the front page, that was amazing.
Right. And you know, and that still held up into the 90s, to be honest.
Oh, yeah. No, that was a huge thing. I mean, that idea that you could get, you know, and be on the same page with Nat Hentoff or Andrew Saras, you know, who invented the auteur theory, or, you know, some of the other amazing, you know, political writers that were there, you know, like Newfield and so forth. I mean, I've never had an experience like it. The closest thing I've had since then is sometimes working, if you work on a really good or interesting movie or TV project, you get around a lot of creative people, you have that sustained thing. But there's never been any place that I've been to that year after year, you go to the office and you're going to run into a big, super smart person who's really gifted at what they do and really passionate about what they're interested in.
Yeah.
And Chris Gayle, just to talk about Chris Gayle a minute, you know.
Sure.
Chris Gayle was an incredible editor. I mean, this guy edited me. He edited Tate. He edited, you know, Gary Giddens, edited Stanley Crouch. He was editing Lester Bangs. So this is a huge range of thought and writing styles. I don't think any of us found it like the other in any way, shape, or form. But when you work with Chris Gayle, he pushed you to be a better writer, but he never imposed himself on your words, on your work. He pushed you to find the right word. And we would sit there, you know, okay, you know, is it urgent? Yeah, it's a cliche. Is it, you know, is it yearning? That's
right,
a cliche.
Right, you'd sit
there and you'd go through the word. I don't think I've ever had that kind of experience with any editor.
Before or since.
You really talked about the words. And what's the right word for this thing? And have a real discussion about what the right word is. But him not imposing the right word on you that he thought was the right word, you had to find it for yourself. So I thought that I found him to be amazing. And the fact that he could work with such a wide range of personalities, and many of whom didn't like each other, you know. So you have that too. I mean, you know, there's the famous Harry Allen, Stanley Crouch dust ups.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting about, you know, Crouch, who was such a dominant figure in terms of jazz and, is it Stanley at first was, I felt he was pretty dismissive of all of the young hip hop R&B writers. It wasn't until much later, until I think the late 80s and definitely in the early 90s, that he began like giving us some respect. But, you know, we ended up becoming really good friends, you know, years later. I think he mellowed a bit as well.
Maybe just a touch.
Yeah. But so the voice for me was, you know, was a great learning ground. I think I became a writer there. And I think Chris Gayle is an integral part of me. One more thing I'd say about him as an editor is that actually we talked about the words, but we really, really talked about thinking. And that is, okay, this record's by Rick James, this record's by Rakim, this record's by Public Enemy or R. Kelly. What is it about this record that you're going to say about it that takes it beyond being a record review and makes it a thematic essay that has some intellectual weight? And so, you know, the record that you looked at and you really want to write about, but like, you know, dude, I really can't figure it out. This is just a record. So maybe we can do a couple of records in this review and not just this, because it doesn't have the weight to sustain a real essay. And then you come up with something else. And like, you know, one of my favorite pieces was on Eric B. and Rakim, I think their second album, or third album for The Voice. I just compared Rakim to Chester Heim, the great black detective novel. And that was one of my favorite articles, only because it felt like I was trying to bring connections between the culture, blah, blah, blah. And that's The Voice really encouraged that kind of thought and thinking. I don't really feel like right now, I mean, because of the nature of the internet, I don't feel like there's any editors out there.
No, that's not a thing anymore.
So that's a big problem. And I think that's one reason why it's harder. I think it's very much harder for younger writers to get that authority, because there was when you went through a Chris Gayle edit, you know, you were going to write as good as you could write. He wasn't going to let you go out weak. So he was going to push you to rethink or to push your language. And so when that thing got published, you were really proud of that piece, because it wasn't something that was tossed out. You know, it was something that had to be really, even if it was written quickly,
right,
it had to be done with a certain kind of thought and polish. So much writing today is grinded out without any real, you know, and no editing and no fact checking and no proofreading. So, you know, someone may have a really good piece that's in there, and it could have been a great piece. It's never going to be a great piece because it wasn't really edited.
I really appreciate you walking us through the germinal 1.0 stuff, because without that, none of us have jobs, and I don't get to sit here. So I appreciate that so much.
It's a weird thing, man, to look back on, because that this year is actually the this summer, like the 40th anniversary of me writing that Cool Herc article.
Yep.
So it was really interesting to think that when that was written, I can believe it. There was no thought in my mind that that article would have any resonance 40 years later, much less 3 years later.
And look at us now.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Hey, thank you so much again.
Okay, man. Be well, man.
One of the key things about The Voice and The Voice's music section is it wasn't limited to pop music. There was classical coverage, there was jazz coverage with Gary Giddens. And when I was younger, one of the things that I always would read with fascination and a little bit of almost fear was the new music coverage, the modern classical coverage. Kyle Gann is someone who covered a scene that I knew nothing about and forced me as a reader and a listener to engage with and take seriously music that was completely out of my comfort zone, but I knew it had to be taken seriously because The Voice was taking it seriously. And so to talk for a little bit about The Voice outside of pop, I got Kyle on the phone. Kyle is currently a professor of music at Bard, and he's calling in from Bard right now. Hey, man, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for coming on today. I'd love to talk about The Voice in your era, and also The Voice's relationship with non-pop spaces, especially in the 80s and 90s, when I think especially there was probably a little bit more fluidity between what I think of as like classic voice pop and rock and taste, but then also the scenes that you were in. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what The Voice's relationship was with those sounds and spaces.
Sure. Well, it started off very early with Carmen Moore in the 60s writing about experimental music. And I remember there was a cover story when the cellist Charlotte Mormon played a piece of by Nam June Paik, bare-breasted with TVs on her breast. She was taken to trial for it, and Carmen Moore covered that trial. And so I think it kind of came from a time when that music had a little more notoriety and actually got into the news for non-musical reasons. But that started with then Tom Johnson, and there was also Leighton Koerner, who did conventional classical music.
Yes.
And it's too bad he's not still around, because he was a wonderful guy. But The Voice started this commitment to kind of experimental music and what was called downtown music, because it was the music that was being played in downtown New York.
It's funny because I think people can see it through either lens. They can see it through experimental pop and post-pop, or they can see it through experimental composition and classical.
Downtown was a scene for people who had largely come from a classical music or else jazz background, mm-hmm. but who just couldn't survive in the classical music atmosphere. The classical music establishment is so straitjacketed, and it was just people who wanted to quit being boxed in and make music out of whatever they wanted. The Voice was the only publication that made such a commitment to that music that when Tom Johnson reviewed it all through the 70s, when he left, they hired Greg Sandow to cover it. And when Greg left, they hired me to cover it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just determined to have that position there. And so I came in 1986, and my wonderful editor, Doug Simmons, took me in. And the job description he gave me was go to 4 or 5 concerts a week and write about whatever you want. And then as an afterthought, he said, you'll be expected to concentrate on the downtown scene.
And were you, as a critic, were you okay with that? Like, was that?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, that's what you wanted.
I was. People recommended me for the job because I'd been doing that in Chicago.
And you also make music, like in addition
yeah.
to, mm-hmm. right, you also are creating in that space.
Yeah.
So there was a tradition of covering that kind of music. You know, obviously The Voice was such a hotbed for high-minded criticism across disciplines. Did you feel a certain weight on your shoulders when you arrived at the paper to do this kind of work? Did you feel an extra responsibility?
Well, I wouldn't say extra, because I was picking up where my predecessors had left off.
Right.
And, you know, there were certain institutions in downtown Manhattan that were internationally central to this music, like the Kitchen was such a big center for experimental music. And within the context of downtown, the Kitchen wasn't a place you could afford to ignore. You know, there was so much music going on there, and La Mama and Roulette and other spaces like
right.
that. It
mm-hmm.
was no other geographic location would have had so many institutions championing that music.
Back in the day, like when I would cover, say, you know, like independent rap in New York, and not a lot of other people were covering that, but I would cover it in The Voice. There was an intimacy between the scene and the publication. Like, everybody read everything. It was like an ongoing dialogue. Did the people who were in the scene making music, throwing the concerts, owning the venues, were they very invested in Voice criticism and Voice coverage of what they did?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, one composer of a generation older than me wanted to meet me when I first came to The Voice, because he really hadn't liked the way that the criticism had been going with Greg Sandow, and he wanted to make sure I would take a different path. And I became very supportive of his music. He was a good guy. But yes, it was. Yeah, I was under intense scrutiny.
Yeah, and I would imagine for many of them, you maybe not only were because it's the hometown paper, but also, like you said, it's not that there's loads of coverage of this kind of music. So really,
right.
you end up being the focal point, I imagine.
Yes.
Like, hey, can we impress Kyle? Is Kyle gonna?
Yeah.
Is Kyle like it?
And I had come from Chicago, and so they didn't know who I was, and you know, I seemed like some arrogant Midwesterner. And the scene that always meant the most to me was minimalism.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, that was my bias. There are non-minimalists whose music I dearly love, but that was what I had been writing about in Chicago. And I know that, you know, every new critic who came in displeased somebody. Lamont Young didn't like Tom Johnson. Everybody else mm-hmm. loved Tom Johnson, but he did. Tom Johnson wrote negative reviews of the well-tuned piano, and Lamont just hated him.
Well, it's good to know that there are critic-artist beefs in all genres, not just in my side of the world. It's good to know that it happens elsewhere, too. When did you stop writing the new music page?
Well, they cut me back from full-time in 1997, which luckily was the same week I got the job here at Bard.
Mm-hmm.
And I had fewer and fewer reviews then up until 2005. And then they sold the paper. They sent me a new contract, which at a greatly reduced page rate.
Right.
And I just didn't sign it.
Yes.
I was working full time here. I didn't need the.
Sure. With you doing the work that you were doing at The Voice during the stretch that you were doing it, did other people at other publications then start to try to do it? Or did The Voice have a total kind of, you know, like a monopoly or an effective
it
monopoly
was,
it on
was it? It was pretty much a monopoly. You know, the first place I read articles about Terry Riley and Philip Glass, Playboy magazine.
Mm,
and most publications ignored that music for a long, long time. And The Voice was always ahead of the curve on it. And I don't think any other publication ever tried to pick up that beat. I don't think we had any imitators in that respect.
Right. And that's one of the things that made The Voice special, is that they, you know, they took this thing seriously that other people didn't make the space for. Well, look, man, I appreciate you calling in and talking to us today and giving us this perspective, because it's like I said, it's reassuring for me to hear that all the things that were going on my side were also going on yours.
Yeah. Well, it's very, very nostalgic to hear about it again. It was a very exciting time of my life.
Well, I'm glad we could get a little bit of that onto the podcast today. Hey, thanks for calling in. I appreciate
it. Okay. Sure.
Coming to the line right now, calling in from his New York home, it's Joe Levy. Hey, Joe.
John. How are you, man?
I'm blessed, man.
You're blessed. You're way up. You're way, way up.
You know me, man. Joe Levy has a better podcast and radio voice than I could ever aspire to have. That's a number one gift. Joe was the music editor of The Voice for quite a few years. We're talking 89 to the mid-90s, if I'm not mistaken.
1989 to 1994.
Is currently a contributing editor at Rolling Stone and also the host of the Inside the Studio podcast, which you can hear on the iHeartRadio network. Joe is also a person who I was on a panel with on some show a couple years ago and was just impeccably smooth. Also, I saw you shopping. Was it a Saint Laurent? Where did I bump into you? In Soho. And you were out there copping wild.
Now, where'd I bump into you in Soho, spending money? Everywhere. You know me. I'm the original Louis Vuitton Don. No, it was probably Saint Laurent.
Here's what I know about.
You can get that podcast on the iHeartRadio network or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Here's what I know about you is that the store was new and this clerk's already knew your name. So that's a real one, if ever there were one. Joe, thanks for talking to us today. I appreciate it.
I'm just living. Yeah. All right, John, what's going on?
Tell me about The Voice that you arrived into in the late 80s, because The Voice in the 80s is sort of the stuff of it feels like the stuff of legend, to be honest. So tell me about the climate of music criticism at The Voice in that time period that you then arrived into.
Well, I mean, The Voice for me is where everything started. That's where my career started. I was an intern at The Village Voice in 1987 for Doug Simmons, the music editor. Mm-hmm. And The Voice in that era in the 80s was amazing. The music section was amazing. How important, how influential. When U2 won a Grammy in, what was it, 88? Bono, accepting it, says, does this mean we can get a good review from The Village Voice now? Damn. Which it didn't.
Bono, stop being a crybaby. We're not here for it.
And the thing is that what Christgau did for punk rock and CBGBs with The Voice music section in the 70s, Doug Simmons and certainly the critics of The Voice, Nelson George, Greg Tate, Lisa Jones, a lot of other people, mm-hmm. did for hip-hop in the 80s and 90s. So in the 80s, Barry Michael Cooper writes a Teddy Riley profile where he coins the phrase New Jack Swing.
Essential.
And gives name to that genre, and eventually goes on to write the script for the movie New Jack City. There's a fantastic, fantastic cover story, Hip Hop Nation, with just an unbelievably great Greg Tate piece at the center of it, where all of these rappers, at the time that rap is exploding, come together for a photograph. And, you know, rap in 1988, man, it was one thing after another. Mm-hmm. One titanic seismic shift after another. So for sure, The Village Voice is the first place that I read about Public Enemy, mm-hmm. but it was while I was working at The Village Voice that I first saw Public Enemy. I was an intern in 87. There was a benefit for The Village Voice strike committee. It was at a club that existed then on 13th Street called the Cat Club. And The Voice offices were literally across the street on Broadway and 14th Street. And on the bill that night, two New York groups, Public Enemy and Sonic Youth. And I'd heard Public Enemy's record. I'd never seen them perform. I would see them a lot over the next few years. And they come into that club. I mean, the show that you would see at Nassau Coliseum or Madison Square Garden mm-hmm. was already in place. I mean, the S1Ws, all of these guys with the Public Enemy logo on the back of their jeans jacket, it was impressive. This show was arena-sized before they were in arenas. And Sonic Youth had the job of going up on stage after them and basically said, maybe we'll do an instrumental set because Public Enemy used all the words. And remember, this is in 1987, so the following year...
Was that an insult, or was that...
what do we do now?
Right.
Public Enemy has used all the language in the world. they have taken all the verbs and nouns out of circulation.
True story.
And think of what's going to happen next year. 1988 is going to bring the masterpieces from those groups. Daydream Nation from Sonic Youth, Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back from Public Enemy. And the year before that, they're playing a strike benefit for the Village Voice. And that was the power of the Voice in New York City and the power of the Music Section in Action, that these two monumental New York noisemakers are going to be on the same bill for a benefit, for the union.
Right, and explain in a little bit more detail, maybe, the Voice in the ecosystem of New York City music culture at that point, and the role that criticism specifically played in that space.
Well, it's hard to make a claim for the role criticism plays in culture. Criticism is a small part of what happens around music. There's music that has tremendous audience, tremendous power, with or without the criticism, but the Voice had a national audience.
Yeah. And it was distributed nationally. That's a thing that I think we should clarify. There was a point, first of all, the Voice was not a free paper for a time, and it was also distributed widely. Like, you get it at a cool place in Boston.
Yeah, I mean, if you want the history lesson, let me get my first slide. The Voice was an enormously successful commercial newspaper. And people need to understand that the Voice set an example, not just the Music Section, but set an example for alternative weeklies nationwide. Mm-hmm. You could make money. The Voice began to make its money, in part, during a newspaper strike in the, 60s or 70s. The unions went on strike. The Voice wasn't unionized yet. Advertising dollars flowed in. And after that, they didn't flow out until Craigslist.
Right.
So the Voice Music Section, you've seen Desperately Seeking Susan, mm-hmm. starring Madonna and Rosanna Arquette, right?
Good movie. Good fashion.
Fantastic fashion.
Yeah.
Fantastic movie. Here's the thing. The classified ad, Desperately Seeking Susan, mm-hmm. that's not just modeled on the Voice classifieds. I'm pretty sure that the guy who takes the classified ads, who, by the way, is Arto Lindsay.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Yeah, for real. Arto Lindsay plays the guy taking the classified ads.
That's funny.
Richard Hell is in that movie, too. But I believe he's in the old classified department at The Voice on Broadway.
Oh, you think that it was filmed in that office?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, okay. I recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Voice was an expanding commercial venture in the 1980s.
Right.
It did have national distribution. It had strong newsstand sales. It was expanding. There was a fashion section. There was a fashion section of The Voice, but there was a special section called View. A young photographer named Nan Golden did some photographic work for that. I mean, they had the ability to get people from the fine art world into a weekly newspaper in New York shooting these high-concept fashion stories.
And that era of The Voice that you're talking about into the era that where you were the music editor, this is the era for me personally that starts to define my relationship with music and music writing. I was in high school, 89 to 93, and would pick up The Voice, in the newsstand or on the corner and read it on the bus home. And that's where my musical imagination was really set off.
Yeah, that Music Section.
Just heavy hitters.
Certainly for people who loved music, but it was also for people who loved writing about music.
Yeah.
And it was a chance to do things in terms of language, in terms of ideas, and in terms of the music covered outside the mainstream. I would say one of the things I brought to the paper was an interest in mainstream pop music and criticism of mainstream pop music.
Right.
But bigger ideas about it. And in the era before me, there were a lot of great writers that Doug Simmons brought in, like Barry Walters, who did that kind of criticism, who I admired. And I wanted to build on that. I was able to bring in certain writers like Rob Sheffield. But I put enough pop music in there that early on in my tenure, I got an aggrieved letter from Thurston Moore of Sonic Youth.
Hey.
Well, what's up, man? You're missing all the great music. Where are the voice choices, which were a big deal, the choices section, picks for gigs?
Yep.
Where are all the choices for the important bands coming through? Like last week, the Action Swingers, who were a band that no one remembers, a spinoff, I believe, of Pussy Galore. The Action Swingers played this week. Heliocs Creed is in town. Like, if you don't get this stuff done, I'll do it for you pseudonymously. And I was like, terrified. I was like, Thurston Moore is writing to me and he's upset. And luckily, I had already assigned a review of that Helios Creed show. So I was like, okay. Well,
look at you anticipating the need.
He won't be angry forever.
No, he might be. Well, the truth is he might be, just not at you.
We had a lot of constituencies. Mm-hmm. That's my point. That the Voice was an important paper in terms of covering music outside of New York, and that didn't just mean the indie rock, punk rock, experimental art rock that Thurston was interested in. It meant hip-hop.
Mm-hmm.
It also meant mainstream pop music. As far as I was concerned, that was part of the responsibility. You know, it was a place for different voices,
yeah,
different writers, different kinds of music.
How did you conceptualize what the Voice should be delivering and achieving in music writing up against what by that point was obviously Rolling Stone, Spin? You start to have the rap press coming into focus in the early 90s. How did you understand what the Voice's role was in that shifting picture?
It was a unique role, certainly. As I say, it was music writing for people interested in music, but also interested in music writing.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. many of the other things you mentioned were really for people who were more interested in the music than the writing. No disrespect. Listen, I came to the Village Voice from Spin.
Mm-hmm.
And although I worked somewhere else in between, I then worked for Rolling Stone for 10 years. And I conceived of those audiences differently.
Yeah.
Those were more mainstream audiences who needed music described in a very approachable way. It was not a chance to make things as complex, intellectual, sometimes as insular mm-hmm. as they might get in the Voice music section.
Yeah, I mean,
music section was intellectually ambitious
mm-hmm.
in a different way.
I mean, I remember reading those pieces in the late 80s and early 90s and just genuinely feeling like I had been dropped in the middle of the ocean and I just had to swim and figure it out. I didn't feel like I was being led anywhere. You know, like my hand wasn't being held. When we were emailing earlier, you talked a little bit about some of the writers and some of the specific pieces. You want to talk about the first New York Pavement show?
The first time Pavement played New York, they had two singles out. I asked Gerard Cosloy, who would eventually end up putting their records out through Matador. But Gerard had a fanzine called Conflict, which was the funniest music writing in the world, also some of the meanest. And I asked Cosloy if he would cover the Pavement show at the Pyramid Club. And he was like, yeah, everything I have to say about them, I've already said in Conflict, so I'm not sure why I would do this. And that show was bananas. It was kind of crazy because no one had seen them. They had no press. They had no press mm-hmm. photos. They had a kind of anti-image going. They were a mystery band. They come out on stage and they've got this long stringy hair, which they have until the last song when somebody runs through the stage and pulls their wigs off. It was a freaking hilarious, weird show. It upended any idea you had about weird underground indie rock. I mean, it was fun. There were girls there, John. It was a good time. And on my way out, I was walking up to the stage. I had a cassette tape of this music, and they were selling the singles. One of the hilarious things is that the singles were limited edition, and they were numbered, and I'm pretty sure they all had the same number on them.
Mm-hmm.
But they were selling them out of like a canvas duffel bag up on stage. And I'm walking to the stage to buy my Pavement singles.
Faithfully.
And Gerard Cosloy passes me on his way out, and he looks over at me. He goes, when's it due? And he wrote the single greatest Pavement review that was ever written in about a weekend,
mm-hmm.
which cracked me up because afterwards I heard the guys in Pavement said, they read it and said, I thought Gerard liked us.
That is it's interesting to hear you say that because that is certainly a thing that I, as a younger person, would occasionally find vexing about Voice criticism is I would get to the end and I was unclear if it was a positive or a negative review. And now later in life, I came to see that as an asset and understood what that criticism was achieving. But I also, for a perhaps less generous, open-minded, freaky reader, that is not what these critical pieces were intended to do. They were not, unless it was Bob coming through the Consumer Guide grades and basically being like, A-, go get it. But the longer pieces sometimes didn't show their hand in that regard.
Right. They were meant to engage the music and engage ideas around the music.
Right.
And when I say around the music, that was a pretty broad, wide circle.
Yeah.
It could sometimes be very specific to the music, and I gave people a lot of latitude. Sometimes it worked out great, and I'm here to tell you, sometimes it confused even me.
You also put together a really big Madonna package that had a lot of kind of essential voice stuff in it.
Things worked at a different, this was in 1992, and things worked at a different pace.
Yeah.
The idea of any kind of media now is that it has to happen in the moment itself. So that even when you get a surprise release, Eminem just put out a record. Nobody knows about it. It came out at midnight. I'm a little tired of the takes at 12:05.
Yep.
You know, you've got to get it done instantaneously. And with most work, that means you've got to get it done in advance. So you've got to live in a predictive bubble, which is obviously not how culture unfolds. The advantage of working at a weekly newspaper, besides having a week to get stuff ready, as opposed to 20 minutes or a day,
mm-hmm.
was that you could see how people reacted, you could see something bubble up, and you could react to those things. So in 1992, Madonna put out The Sex Book and Erotica. And the world turned on her, a world that had been clamoring to see as much of Madonna as possible, invading her privacy at every right. turn, did not like it when she stepped out into the road naked and tried to hitch a ride.
And this is also sort of a
photograph in the sex book.
Right. And this is also sort of kind of a quasi puritanical moment in pop music's reception in the broader space. This is like sort of not too far away from the PMRC stuff. There's a little bit of the backlash in a bigger picture of kind of pop successes.
Well, I mean, I think we're pretty distant from the world of the PMRC at this particular mm-hmm. point. That's really an 80s phenomenon mm-hmm. that Madonna, with the help of Prince, George Michael, and others, obliterated.
Mm-hmm.
But I take your point. What I really see this as is the world turning, as the world so often does. It doesn't matter whether it's Madonna then or Lady Gaga with Art Pop, turning on its icons,
okay.
particularly its female musical icons. What I see it is that the misogyny that lurks under all corners, under all aspects of American culture, just saying, like, do I get to come out now? Are you ready for me now? Okay, I'm here. We all hate this. You tried too hard. You did too much. We don't like you or what you do. And in certain moments, it's really transparent that that's all this is. The world turning on Madonna for exposing herself too much is a remarkable thing because, and somebody's going to yell at me for this, but I would say Erotica, her best record. Certainly music. Yeah, there you go. You're
I'm
laughing.
Not yelling.
You're laughing already.
You know what it is? I'm jubilant with the idea that you are sharing that in a public venue. It's not even about agreeing or disagreeing. I'd
love for you to tell me a record that is better or more consistent. It's open to argument, but if you don't want to call it your best, it's a consistent musical work. It lacks the goofs of other albums of mm-hmm. hers that were more celebrated, but had moments of head-smacking nonsense.
All right, I will give you, just looking at the discography, I'll give you top three.
Top three is fine with me. Yeah. And we saw the reaction. I went to certain people who had certain specialities that we worked with, Vince Aletti, now no longer at The Voice, mm-hmm. Now writing about photography occasionally for The New Yorker. But Vince Aletti wrote about the photo book as a photo book, as a work of photographic art.
Right.
Simon Frith, the great British academic and critic, wrote about the music as music. And Mim Yudovich, who is one of the great prose stylists of all time, in the world of profile writing, popular culture, wrote about Madonna as Madonna.
Right.
And if I remember right, actually got Madonna on the phone because The Voice was a hometown paper to her.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very famous on the street photograph of her that ran in the Voice style section before she was Madonna. And Mim gets her on the phone, talks to her, ends up in her piece. And if I remember right, we ran a short Q&A about her preferred waxing methods, because this was of interest to Mim and clearly on display in that book, John. Clearly on display in that book.
I can't think of a better anecdote with which to go out. Joe Levy, thank you so kindly for your time.
Thanks.
Appreciate you always. Bang! Caught you looking for the same thing. It's a new thing. That's part one of our Voice retrospective. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. You should email us, especially, and I said this earlier and I meant it, if you know where I can get a red voice box without stealing one off a corner, email at podcast@nytimes.com. Subscribe to the podcast anywhere you get your audio content. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We're back next week. The minute they see me, fear me, I'm the epitome of public enemy. Used, abused, without clues, I refuse to blow a fuse. They even had it on the news.